things went with Dane last night. I want to know whether she's replied to the texts or confronted him, and what happened. I feel protective and worried for her, but there's literally nothing I can do, and I can't call Ethan either, because we all know he's on the Dane train until the end of the tracks. Given that I'm off tonight, getting out of my apartment, and my head, becomes a priority. I dread going to the gym, but whenever I get in front of the punching bag, I'm amazed how much better I feel. I've started walking dogs at the local Humane Society and have a new golden retriever buddy named Skipper that I'm considering bringing home for Mom as a surprise. Whether it would be a good surprise or a bad one, I'm not sure, which is why I'm still considering it. I help a few of my neighbors shovel their walkways, go to a talk on art and medicine at the Walker Arts Center, and meet Diego for a late lunch. He hasn't heard from Amy today either. It's strange to realize that as soon as I got off the career treadmill, my life suddenly started to feel like mine again. I feel like I can look up for the first time in a decade. I can breathe. There's a reason Ethan didn't know much about my job. I never talked about it. It was what I did, not who I was. And even though many of my breaths ache, because I miss Ethan, I do. I miss him so much it hurts. Not having the weight of a corporate job on my shoulders is an unbelievable relief. I never knew I was this person. I feel more myself than I've ever been. Amy calls at 5, when I've just walked in my front door and I'm making a beeline for the lint roller. Skipper is a shedder, even in early February. I haven't heard her voice in 2 weeks, and I can hear the way my own shakes when I answer. Hello? Hey, Ollie. I leave a long, quiet pause. Hey, Amy. Her voice comes out thick and strangled. I'm really sorry. I have to swallow a few times to get past the clog of emotions in my throat. Are you okay? No, she says, and then, but yes. Do you want to come over tonight? I made lasagna. I chew my lip for a few beats. Is Dane going to be there? He'll be here later, she admits. Please, Holly, I really want you to be here tonight. There's something about the way she's said it that makes me feel like it's more than just sister reconnecting time. Okay, I'll be over in 20. I look at myself in the mirror every day, so it shouldn't be so jarring to see Amy standing on her porch waiting for me. But it is. We've never gone 2 weeks without seeing each other, even in college. I was at the U, she was at St. Thomas, and even in the busiest week, we still saw each other at dinner on Sundays. I wrap my arms around her as tight as they'll go and squeeze even tighter when I can tell she's crying. It feels like that first inhale after holding my breath as long as I can. I missed you, she says through a sob into my shoulder. I missed you more. This sucks, she says. I know. I pull back, wiping her face. How are you? She trails off, and then we sort of stand there, grinning at each other through the telepathy because the answer is obvious. My wedding was ruined by food poisoning, I missed my honeymoon, and now my husband may be cheating on me. I'm alive. Is he home? Work. She straightens, taking a deep breath and pulling herself together. He'll be home around 7. She turns and leads me inside. I love their house. It's so open and bright, and I'm grateful that Amy has such a strong decorating sense, because I assume if it was left up to Dane, the decor would be a lot of Vikings purple, dartboards, and maybe some hipster leather couches and a craft cocktail cart that he'd never use. Amy moves to the kitchen, pouring us each a big glass of wine. I laugh when she hands mine to me. Oh, so it's that kind of night. She nods, smiling even though I can tell there's nothing happy happening in her body right now. You have no idea. I still feel like I have to tiptoe around the topic, but I can't help but ask. Did you take his phone last night? What's the latest? I did. Amy takes a long drink and then looks at me over the rim of her glass. I'll tell you all about it later. She tilts her head, indicating that I should follow her into the family room, where she's already got our plates of lasagna set up on two TV trays. Well, this looks comfy, I tell her. She curtsies, flops down onto the couch, and hits play on The Big Sick. We missed it in the theater and kept meaning to watch it, so there's a sweet little ache that rises in my throat, knowing that she waited to see it with me. The lasagna is perfect, the movie is wonderful, and I almost forget that Dane lives here. But then an hour into the movie, the front door opens. Amy's entire demeanor shifts. She sits up, hands on her thighs, and takes a deep breath. You okay? I whisper. Am I here for moral support while she confronts her husband? I can't decide whether that will be fantastic or excruciating or both. I hear Dane drop his keys on the counter, shuffle through the mail, and then call out, Hey, babe. Hey, honey, she calls back, brightly, falsely, and it is so incongruous with the bleak way she looks at me. My stomach drops in a weird burst of anticipatory stress, and then Dane is there in the doorway. He sounds surprised and displeased. Oh, hey, Olive. I don't bother turning around. Go to hell, Dane. Amy chokes on her wine and then looks at me, eyes shining with amusement and tension. Honey, there's lasagna in the oven if you want some. I can feel him still looking at the back of my head. I know he is, but he just stands behind me for a few more seconds before saying quietly, Okay, I'll grab some and leave you two to it.
Thanks, hon, Amy calls out.
She glances at her watch and then reaches for the remote, turning the volume down. I'm so nervous, I'm nauseated. Amy, I say, leaning in, what's going on?
I texted them, she says, and my jaw drops. I'm screaming inside.
I see it, too. The tightness around her eyes, the way I can tell she's holding back tears.
I had to do it this way. Do what exactly, Amy? I ask.
But before she can answer, the doorbell rings. Amy's attention shoots over my shoulder, toward the door leading to the kitchen, and we listen as Dane walks across the tile entryway to answer it. Slowly, so slowly I can see she's shaking, Amy stands.
Come on, she says quietly to me, and then she calls out to Dane with a calm clarity I can't believe. Who's at the door?
I follow Amy out just as Dane is frantically trying to guide a woman back outside, and my blood pressure drops. Did she text the women as Dane and invite them here? Oh my God.
Who is it, honey?
Amy repeats, innocently. The woman pushes past Dane.
Who's that?
I'm his wife, Amy.
Amy stretches out her hand.
Which one are you?
Which one am I? The woman repeats, too thunderstruck to return Amy's handshake. She glances at Dane, and her face pales too.
Cassie.
Dane turns, ashen, and stares at my sister.
Babe.
For once, I see Amy's jaw twitch at the pet name, and I want to shoot a rocket of joy into the sky because I knew she hated it and just pretended to like it. Twin powers for the win.
Excuse me, Dane, Amy says sweetly. I'm in the middle of introducing myself to one of your girlfriends.
I can see the panic in his eyes.
Babe, this totally isn't what you think.
What do I think it is, babe? She asks, eyes wide with faux curiosity.
Another car pulls into the driveway, and a woman slowly emerges, taking in the scene in front of her. She looks like she just got off work. She's wearing nurse's scrubs and her hair is in a bun. It occurs to me that this is not how you dress for someone you're trying to impress. It's how you dress for someone you've known for a long time and are comfortable around. I can't help but glare at Dane. What a complete dirtbag. Amy looks at me over her shoulder and says to me,
That must be Trinity.
Oh, my God. My sister is currently blowing up Dane's game, and she doesn't even need a checklist to do it. This is nuclear-level madness. Dane pulls Amy aside, leaning down to meet her eyes.
Hey, what are you doing, hun?
I thought I should meet them.
Her chin shakes, and it's painful to watch.
I saw the messages on your phone.
I haven't, he starts.
Yeah, Cassie says quietly.
You have. Last week.
She looks at Amy, then at me.
I didn't know he was married. I swear I had no idea.
She turns and makes her way back to her car, passing the other woman, who stopped several yards away. I can tell from Trinity's expression that she's figured out what's happening here.
You're married?
She says flatly from a distance.
He's married,
Amy confirms. Trinity looks back at Dane when he sits down on the doorstep and puts his face in his hands.
Dane, she says, this is so fucked up.
He nods.
I'm sorry.
To her credit, Trinity looks directly at Amy.
We haven't been together in a while, if that helps. What's a while?
Amy asks. Trinity lifts a shoulder, drops it.
5 months or so.
Amy nods, breathing deep and fast, struggling to not cry.
Amy, I say, go inside. Lie down. I'll be in a second.
She turns and quickly dodges Dane's outstretched hand as she passes. A car door slams down at the street, and my heart lurches. How many more women are going to show up tonight? But it isn't another woman. It's Ethan. He's coming from work, wearing fitted gray pants and a blue dress shirt, looking good enough to climb. I'm shell-shocked by what's happening and trying to keep my shit together so I can be strong for Amy, but I still feel like I've been turned inside out at the sight of him.
Oh,
Amy says from the door, loud enough for everyone to hear.
I invited Ethan, too, Ollie. I think he owes you an apology.
And then she quietly closes the front door behind her. Trinity meets my eyes and gives me a dry smile.
Good luck with this.
Looking down at Dane, she says,
I thought it was weird that you texted me to come over after disappearing months ago.
She gnaws her lip, looking more disgusted than upset.
I hope she leaves you.
With that, she climbs into her car and pulls out of the driveway. Ethan has stopped a few feet away to watch this interaction, his brows furrowed in recognition. He turns his attention to me.
Olive, what's going on here?
I think you know what's going on here.
Dane looks up, eyes red and swollen. Apparently, he'd been crying behind that hand.
Amy invited them here, I guess.
He lifts his hands, defeated.
Holy shit. I can't believe what just happened.
Ethan looks at me again and then back to his brother.
Wait, so you really were just a couple times with Cassie,
Dane says. And Trinity about 5 months ago, I add helpfully. This moment is in no way about me and Ethan, but I can't help giving him my best I-told-you-so face. Dane groans,
I'm such an idiot.
I can see when Ethan realizes what he's hearing. It's like an invisible fist punches him in the chest, and he takes a step back before looking up at me with the clarity he should have had 2 weeks ago. God, it should be satisfying, but it isn't. Nothing about this feels good.
Olive, he says quietly, voice thick with apology.
Don't, I say. I have a sister inside who needs me and have zero time for him or his worthless brother.
Take Dane with you when you go.
Turning, I walk back into the house and don't even look back at Ethan as I close the door behind me. Chapter 20. It's a few hours before I get and ignore a call from Ethan. I can only assume he's been busy dealing with Dane, but I am also dealing with Dane, just less directly. I am packing up all of his clothes, and I can feel the intensity of Amy's desire to get him out of the house because, for maybe the first time in her life, it doesn't even occur to her to look for a coupon before she sends me off to buy a giant stack of boxes at Menards. I didn't want to leave her alone while I ran out, so I called Mom, who brought Natalia, Jules, Diego, and Stephanie, who apparently texted Tio Omar and his daughter Tina to bring more wine. Tina and Tio Omar also brought cookies, along with a whole carload of cousins. So faster than you can say, good riddance, dirtbag, there are 22 of us working on packing up every personal trace of Dane Thomas and putting each box in the garage. Exhausted but accomplished, we all land on whatever empty, flat surface we can find in the living room, and it already feels like we have jobs. Mine is to cuddle Amy. Natalia's is to keep her wine glass full. Mom's is to rub her feet. Theo Omar's is to refresh the plate of cookies every now and then. Jules and Diego are handling the music. Tina is pacing the room, detailing precisely how she's going to castrate Dane. And everyone else is cooking enough food for the next month.
Are you going to divorce him? Steph asks carefully, and everyone waits for Mom to gasp. But she doesn't.
Amy nods, her face in her wine glass, and Mom pipes up.
Of course she's going to divorce him.
We all stare at her, stunned, and finally she sighs in exasperation.
Ya basta! You think my daughter is dumb enough to get tangled up in the same stupid game her parents have been playing for 2 decades?
Amy and I look at each other and then burst out laughing. After a heavy beat of incredulous silence, the entire room follows suit, and finally even Mom is laughing too. In my pocket, my phone rings again. I peek but don't get it hidden again fast enough because Amy catches a peek at my contact photo for Ethan on the screen before I can decline the call. Tipsy now, she leans into me.
Aw, that was a good picture. Where did you take that?
It's honestly a little painful to recall that day when Ethan and I rented the hideous lime green Mustang and drove along the Maui coastline, becoming friends for the first time. He kissed me that night.
That was at the Nakalele blowhole, I tell her.
Was it pretty?
It was, I say quietly. Unbelievable, really. The entire trip was. Thank you, by the way. Amy squeezes her eyes closed.
I am so glad Dane and I didn't go.
Staring at her, I ask, seriously?
Why would I regret missing it now? We would have had even more good memories ruined. I should have known it was a bad omen when literally everyone but you and Ethan got sick at the wedding.
She turns her glassy eyes up to me.
It was a sign from the universe.
Dios,
Mom interjects. Diego holds up a finger.
Beyonce.
That you and Ethan are the ones who should be together,
Amy slurs.
Not me and Dane.
I agree,
Mom says.
So do I,
Tio Omar calls from the kitchen. I hold up my hands to stop them all. I don't think Ethan and I are going to happen, guys. My phone rings again, and Amy stares right at me, eyes suddenly clear.
He's always been the good brother, hasn't he?
He's been the good brother, I agree. But not the best boyfriend or the best brother-in-law. I lean forward, kissing her nose. You, on the other hand, are the best wife, sister, and daughter. And you are very loved.
I agree, Mom says again. So do I,
Diego says, lying across our laps.
So do I,
a chorus calls from the kitchen. The good brother continues to call me a few times a day for the next several days, and then transitions to texts that say simply, I'm sorry. Olive, please call.
I feel like such an enormous jerk. When I don't respond to any of them, he seems to take the hint and stops trying to get in touch with me, but I'm not sure if that's better or worse. At least when he was calling and texting, I knew he was thinking about me. Now he might be focused on moving on, and I'm so conflicted over how that makes me feel. On the one hand, screw him for not having my back, for enabling his brother to be a terrible boyfriend/husband, for being obstinately obtuse about a serial cheater. But on the other hand, what would I do in the same situation to protect Amy? Would it be hard to see her as sketchy the same way it was hard for Ethan to see Dane? On top of that, Ethan was so perfect in all other respects. Witty, playful, infatuated, and stellar in bed. It honestly feels so crappy to lose my boyfriend because we disagreed with a fight that didn't even involve us, really, rather than because we weren't a good fit. We were a good fit. Our ending, by contrast, still seems so jagged and unfinished. About a week after Dane leaves, I move out of my apartment and into Amy's house. Amy doesn't particularly want to be alone, and it works for me, too. I like the idea of saving to buy a place of my own, or having some extra in the bank for an adventure, once I figure out what kind of adventure I want to have. I see all these choices unrolling in front of me. Career, travel, friends, geography. And despite things being insane and hard and messy, I don't think I've ever liked myself more than I do now. It's the strangest feeling to be proud simply because I'm taking care of me and mine. Is this what it's like to grow up? Amy is so oddly, constitutionally solid that once Dane picks up his stuff from the garage and officially moves out, she seems mostly fine. It's almost as if the knowledge that he is trash is enough for her to get over him. The divorce doesn't seem like a wild good time, but she plugs ahead through her divorce checklist with the same calm determination with which she sent in the 1,000 sweepstakes entries to win the honeymoon. "I'm going to have dinner with Ethan tomorrow," she says out of the blue while I make us pancakes for dinner. I flip one badly, and it folds in half, batter oozing onto the lip of the pan.
"Why would you do that?"
"Because he asked me," she says, like it's obvious. "And I can tell he feels bad. I don't want to punish him for Dane's sins."
I frown at her. "That's big of you, but you know you could still punish Ethan for Ethan's sins."
"He didn't hurt me." Amy stands to refill her glass of water. "He hurt you, and I'm sure he wants to own that, too. But that's between the two of you, and you have to answer his calls first."
"I don't have to do anything where Ethan Thomas is concerned."
Amy's silence leaves my words to echo back to me, and I realize how they sound. So unforgiving, but familiar. I haven't felt like that version of myself in so long, and I don't like it.
"Well," I amend, "tell me how dinner goes, and I'll decide if he deserves a phone call."
From what I can tell, Amy and Ethan had a great time at dinner. He showed her photos from our Maui trip, ate a sufficient amount of the blame for Dane's past behavior, and generally charmed her senseless.
"Yeah, he's really good at being charming over dinner," I tell her, aggressively unloading the dishwasher. "Remember the Hamiltons in Maui?"
"He told me about that," Amy says and laughs. "Something about being invited to a club where they look at labia in mirrors?" She drinks from her wine glass. "I didn't ask for clarification. He misses you." I try to pretend like this doesn't absolutely thrill me, but I'm sure my sister sees straight through that nonsense. "Do you miss him?" she asks.
"Yes. There's no purpose in lying. A lot. But I opened my heart to him, and he pinched it."
I close the dishwasher and lean against the counter to face her.
"I'm not sure if I'm the kind of person who can open back up again."
"I think you are." But if I'm not, I say, then I think that means I'm smart, right?
Amy smiles at me, but it's her new restrained smile, and it wrecks me a little. Dane killed something in her, some optimistic, innocent light, and it makes me want to scream. And then the irony hits me. I don't want to let Ethan make me cynical again. I like my new optimistic and innocent light.
I want you to know I'm proud of you, she says. I see all the changes you're making.
My life feels like mine again, but I didn't know I needed her to acknowledge it. I take her hand, giving it a little squeeze. Thank you.
We're both growing up, holding some people accountable for their choices, letting other people make amends for theirs.
She lets the sentence trail off and gives me a little grin. Very subtle, Amy.
Wouldn't it be weird for you if Ethan and I got back together? I ask.
She shakes her head and quickly swallows another sip of wine before saying,
No, actually. It would make me feel like everything that happened in the past 3 years happened for a reason.
Amy blinks away, almost like she doesn't want to admit this next part, but can't help herself.
I'm always going to want there to be a reason for it.
I know now that it's a waste of my time looking for reasons, or fate, or luck. But I've definitely come to embrace choices in the past month or so, and I'm going to have to figure out which one I'll make where Ethan is concerned. Do I forgive him, or do I walk away? The night that a choice is put directly in front of me, the unexpected and terrible happens. I am happily working a dinner shift when Charlie and Molly Hamilton are seated in my section. I can't blame the hostess, Shelley, because how would she know that this is perhaps the most awkward dining party she could give me? But the moment I approach the table and they look up, we all fall into a corpse-level silence.
Oh, I say. Hi.
Mr. Hamilton does a double take over the top of his menu.
Olive?
I enjoy waitressing so much more than I ever expected, but I admit I don't enjoy the tiny wince that snags his shoulder when he registers that I'm not just coming up to his table to say hello, but I am in fact here to serve his dinner. This is going to be awkward for all of us.
Mr. Hamilton, Mrs. Hamilton, good to see you.
I smile, nodding to each of them. Inside, I am screaming like a woman being chased with a chainsaw in a horror movie.
I'm supposed to be serving you this evening, but I expect that we would all feel more comfortable if you were put in someone else's section.
Mr. Hamilton gives me an easy, generous grin.
I'm okay with this if you are, Olive.
Ah, but here's the kicker. I am not. Molly looks at him, brows pulled low.
I think she's trying to say she would be more comfortable not having to serve the man who fired her on her first day of work.
My eyes go wide. Is Molly Hamilton on Team Olive here? I smile again at her, then him, struggling to keep a bit of professional distance.
It will just take a moment to get you set up. We've got a beautiful table right by the window for you.
With pinpricks all down my neck, and Molly's hissed,
Are you pleased with yourself now, Charles? You are still trying to fill that position.
Echoing in my ear, I hustle over to Shelley, tell her the situation, and she quickly shuffles a few reservations around. They're moved, given a free appetizer, and I exhale an enormous breath. Dodged that bullet. But then I return to my section to find that Ethan Thomas is seated at the table in their place. He's alone and wearing a gaudy Hawaiian shirt with a vibrant plastic lei, and when I approach the table, mouth agape, I realize that he's brought his own glass, a plastic fluted cocktail cup with a giant $1.99 sticker on it.
What in God's name am I seeing? I ask, aware that at least half of the diners and much of the restaurant staff is watching us.
It's almost like they all knew he'd be here.
Hi, Olive, he says quietly.
He laughs, and seeing him nervous does wiggly, protective things to me.
I was wondering whether you served Mai Tais here.
I say the first thing that comes to mind. Are you drunk?
I'm trying to grand gesture. For the right person. Remember when we had delicious Mai Tais?
He nods to the cup. Of course I remember.
That day, I believe, was the day I fell in love with you.
I turn and glare at Shelley, but she won't meet my eyes. The kitchen staff scurries back into the kitchen. David pretends to be engrossed in something on an iPad near the water pitchers, and if I didn't know better, I'd think that was Amy's flash of dark hair darting down the hall to the bathroom.
You fell in love with me?
I whisper, handing him a menu in a pathetic attempt to make it look like there's nothing to see here.
I did, he says. And I miss you. So much. I wanted to tell you how sorry I am.
Here? I ask.
Here.
While I'm working?
While you're working.
Are you just going to repeat everything I say? He tries to wrestle his smile under control, but I can see how much this exchange lights him up inside. I try to pretend it doesn't do the same to me. Ethan is here. Ethan Thomas is grand gesturing in an ugly shirt with a fake Mai Tai glass. It's taking my brain a little time to catch up to my heart, which is currently jackhammering away beneath my breastbone. It's beating so hard, in fact, that my voice shakes.
Did you coordinate with the Hamiltons for maximum effect here?
The Hamiltons?
He asks, and turns to follow my eyes over to their table.
Oh.
Ducking, he glances up at me, eyes comically wide, as if there's anywhere to hide in that shirt. Oh, Ethan.
Wow, he whispers. They're here? That is a coincidence, and awkward.
That's awkward? I look with meaning at his bright shirt and his day-glow green cup in the middle of the classy, muted dining room of Camellia. But instead of looking embarrassed, Ethan straightens, growling a quiet,
Oh, you're ready for awkward?
He reaches up to begin unbuttoning his shirt.
What are you doing?
I hiss.
Ethan, keep your clothes.
He shrugs out of it, grinning, and words immediately fall away, because beneath his Hawaiian shirt, he's wearing a shiny green tank top that strongly resembles...
Tell me that's not,
I say, biting back a laugh that is so enormous, I'm not sure I'm big enough to contain it.
It was Julietta's,
Ethan confirms, and looks down at his chest.
We had it made out of her dress. Yours is, presumably, still intact in your closet.
I burned it, I tell him, and he looks like he's going to vehemently protest this decision.
Okay, fine, I didn't. I planned to.
I can't help but reach out and touch the slippery satin.
I didn't realize you were attached to it. Of course I am. The only thing better than you in that dress was you out of it.
Ethan stands, and now everyone is really looking at him. He's tall, hot, and wearing a shiny green tank top that leaves nothing to the imagination. Ethan is in great shape. But still,
that really is a terrible color, I say.
He laughs, giddy.
I know. Like, it says a lot that even someone as cute as you can't pull it off.
I watch his smile turn into something heated and seductive.
You think I'm cute?
In a gross way. He laughs at this, and it honestly sends a sharp pang through my chest how much I love that smile on this face.
Cute in a gross way. Okay. You're the worst,
I growl, but I'm grinning and don't pull away when he slides his hand to my hip.
Maybe so, he agrees. But remember what I told you about my penny? How it isn't so much that the penny itself is lucky, but it reminds me of times when good things happened.
He gestures to the shirt and waggles his eyebrows.
I want you back, Olivia.
Ethan, I whisper, and dart my eyes around, feeling the pressure of everyone's attention on us still. This moment is starting to feel like a reconciliation, and as much as my heart and lungs and lady parts are on board for that, I don't want to roll over the deeper issue here, which is that what he did by ignoring my truth wasn't okay. You really hurt me. We had this rare, awesome honesty, and so when you thought I was lying, it was really hard.
I know.
He bends so that his lips are right near my ear.
I should have listened to you. I should have listened to my own instincts. I'm going to feel shitty about that for a long time.
There are two responses in me. One is a joyful, okay then, let's do this. And the other is a fearful, oh hell no. The first feels breezy and light. The second feels comforting and familiar and safe. As good as it feels to be careful and to risk boredom and loneliness over heartache, I don't particularly want comfortable and safe anymore.
I guess you deserve another chance, I tell him, only inches away from his kiss.
You do give a great massage. His smile comes to rest on mine, and the entire restaurant erupts. All around us, people stand from their chairs, and I look up, realizing that men in the corner were Dad and Diego in wigs, and the table of women in the back was Mom, Tia Maria, Jimena, Jules, and Natalia. The woman in the hallway to the bathroom really was Amy, and the restaurant is filled with my family, who are all standing and clapping like I'm the luckiest woman alive. And maybe I am. Looking over, I see the Hamiltons near the window, standing and clapping too. I suspect that they didn't just show up here tonight, that Amy got them here so they could see that what they endured with us in Maui resulted in something enduring between me and Ethan here tonight. But in the end, it doesn't matter. I don't think I've ever imagined happiness like this. Luck, fate, determination, whatever it is, I'll take it. I pull Ethan down to me, feeling the slippery slide of his tank top under my hands and my laugh echoing into our kiss.
Epilogue. 2 years later. Ethan. Man, he is out. Is he drooling? He's a cute sleeper, but deep, wow. I bet people drew on his face in college. Not usually this deep. A pause. I try to open my eyes, but the fog of sleep is still too heavy. I'm tempted to lick his face to wake him up. Would that be mean? Yes. Many have said that my girlfriend and her sister are so similar that even their voices sound the same, but after 2 years with her, I can distinguish Olive's easily. Both voices are soft, with an almost imperceptible accent, but Olive's is huskier, slightly scratchy around the edges, like she doesn't use it much. Always the listener with most people, the observer. Lucas, it's Amy's voice again, wavy and slow as if coming through water. Can you carry him off the plane if we need to? Doubtful. I am jostled. A hand comes up to my shoulder, sliding up my neck to my cheek. Ethan, this is your father. We are landing. It isn't my father, in fact. It's Olive, speaking through her fist directly into my ear. I drag myself out of sleep with intense effort, blinking. The seat in front of me comes into blurry focus. The surface of my eyes feels syrupy. He lives! Olive leans over into my field of vision and grins. Hi. Hi. I lift a heavy hand and rub my face, trying to clear the fog. We're almost on the ground, she says. I swear I just fell asleep. 8 hours ago, she tells me. Whatever Dr. Lucas gave you worked well. I lean forward, looking past Olive in the middle seat and Amy on the aisle, to where Amy's new boyfriend and my longtime friend and physician, Lucas Khalif, sits on the other aisle seat. I think you gave me a dose for a horse. He lifts his chin. You're a lightweight. I fall back against the seat, preparing to close my eyes again, but Olive reaches for me, turning my face to the window so I'll look. The view sucks the breath out of my throat. The intensity of color is like a slap. I missed this the first time we came to Maui, spending the entire flight pretending not to look at Olive's boobs through my anxiety haze. But below us, the Pacific Ocean is a sapphire resting on the horizon. The sky is so blue it's nearly neon. Only a handful of wispy clouds are brave enough to block the view. Holy shit, I say. Told you. She leans in, kissing my cheek. You okay? Groggy. Olive reaches up and tweaks my ear. Perfect, because first up is a dip in the ocean. That'll wake you up. Amy dances in her seat, and I glance at my girlfriend as she takes in her sister's reaction. Amy's excitement is infectious, but Olive's is nearly blinding. Things were hard for her for a long time after losing her job, but it also gave her a clarity she'd never had before. She realized that while she loved science, she didn't particularly love her job. While waiting tables at Camellia, she served a woman who ran a non-profit health advocacy center. After a long meal peppered with intense, enthusiastic conversations while Olive worked a busy dinner shift, Ruth hired Olive as her community education coordinator, in charge of speaking at schools, church groups, retirement communities, and businesses about the science behind vaccines. She gets to geek out all over the Midwest about the flu vaccine now. When she found out where the National Community Health Awareness Winter Conference would be this year, Maui, we knew it was fate. We owed Amy a trip to the island. The landing gear lowers, the plane crosses the coastline and then sweeps over the lush landscape of the island. I glance down my road where Amy has reached across the aisle to hold Lucas's hand. It's fitting that her first time in Maui should be with someone who adores her with as much devotion as he does. And it's fitting that this time Olive and I are headed to Maui, I've got a real ring in my pocket. Day two, and it took some convincing to get Amy to agree to go ziplining. For one, it wasn't free. And also, ziplining essentially requires jumping from a platform, trusting the harness, and flying through the air while hoping there really is a platform on the other side. For a woman like Amy, who relishes keeping a stranglehold on all of the variables possible at any given moment, ziplining isn't ideal. But it's one of the few things Olive and I didn't get to do on our first trip, and my girlfriend would hear no dissent. She did the research for the best location, bought the tickets, and now ushers us up to the platform for our first jump with a no-nonsense wave of her hand. "Step right up," she says. Amy peers over the edge of the platform and then immediately takes a step back. "Wow, it's high." "That's a good thing," Olive reassures her. "It would be way less fun to do this from the ground." Amy stares flatly at her. "Look at Lucas," Olive says. "Lucas isn't scared." He finds himself the object of all of our attention right as he's adjusting himself in the harness. Lucas gives her a little salute, but I tilt my head. "Lucas probably isn't scared because Lucas regularly goes skydiving." "You're supposed to be on my team," Olive growls. "Team, listen to Olive, because this will be fun, damn it." "I'm always on that team." I pause and give her a winning smile. "But is it a good time to suggest a better team name? Or no?" She stares me down, and I fight a smile because if I told her right now that with her blue shorts and white tank top and the blue harness and yellow helmet they've given her, she looks like Bob the Builder, she would murder me with her bare hands. "Look, Amy," she says, and her mouth curls into a delighted grin. "I'll go first." The first drop is 50 feet above a ravine with a platform 150 feet away. 2 years ago, Olive would have waited until everyone was safely on the other side before taking her turn, certain her bad luck would snap the cord or break the platform and end with us all crumpled on the forest floor. But now, I watch as she stands behind the gate, following instructions to wait until her lead is strapped to the pulleys, and then steps out onto the platform. She hesitates for only a moment before taking off in a running leap and sailing, screaming, through the tops of the trees. Amy watches her go. She's so brave. She doesn't say it like it's an epiphany. She just says it like it's a fact, something we've all always known about Olive, a core quality. And it's true, of course. But these little truths finally being spoken out loud are tiny, perfect revelations dropped like jewels in Olive's palm. So even though Olive didn't hear this, it's still awesome to see Amy looking after her twin in wonder like this, like she's still figuring things out about this person she knows as well as she knows her own heart. The last line of the day is one of the biggest in Hawaii, nearly 2,800 feet from platform to platform. The best part is there are two parallel lines. We can ride it in tandem. As we make our way to the top, I remind her where to keep her hands and to angle her wrists the opposite direction that she wants to turn. And remember, even though we're starting side by side, I'll probably make it there faster because I weigh more. She stops, looking up at me. Okay, Sir Isaac Newton, I don't need a lesson. A what? I wasn't giving one. You were mansplaining how gravity works. I go to argue, but her brows go up, as in, think before you speak. And it makes me laugh. She's not wrong. Leaning in, I press a kiss to the top of her yellow helmet. I'm sorry. She scrunches her nose, and my eyes follow the movement. Her freckles were the first thing I noticed about her. Amy has a few, but Olive has 12, scattered just across the bridge of her nose and over her cheeks. I had an idea of what she looked like before we met. Obviously, I knew she was Dane's girlfriend's twin. But I wasn't prepared for the freckles and how they moved with her smile, or the way adrenaline dumped into my veins when she pointed that smile at me and introduced herself. She didn't smile like that at me again for years. Her hair is curly from the humidity and coming loose from her ponytail, and even dressed like Bob the Builder, she's still the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Beautiful, but also very suspicious. That apology was easier to extract than I expected. I run my thumb over a strand of her rebellious hair and push it back from her face. She has no idea how good my mood is right now. I'm struggling to find the right moment to propose, but I'm enjoying every second more than the one that came before it. It makes it hard to choose how and when to do this. Sorry to disappoint, I say. You and your arguing kink. With a blushing eye roll, she turns back toward the group. Shut up. I bite back my smile. Stop making that face. I laugh. How do you know I'm making a face? You're not even looking at me. I don't have to look at you to know you're doing that derpy heart eyes thing. I bend to whisper in her ear. Maybe I'm making a face because I love you, and I like when you're argumentative. I can show you just how much I like it when we get back to the hotel. Get a room. Amy shares a commiserating look with Lucas as he's strapped into the pulley. But then she turns and meets Olive's gaze across the platform. I don't need to understand secret twin telepathy to know that Amy isn't just happy for her sister. She's elated. Amy isn't the only one who believes Olive deserves every bit of bliss this world has to offer. Seeing that tiny, salty woman crack up or melt or light up like a constellation gives me life. Now I just have to get her to agree to marry me. I think I've found my moment when 4 nights in we're given a sunset that's so surreal it feels computer-generated. The sky is this layered parfait of pastels. The sun seems reluctant to disappear entirely, and it's one of those perfect progressions where we can watch it slowly diminish in size until it's nothing but a tiny dot of light, and then, poof, it's gone. It's right then that I hold my phone up, snapping a selfie of Olive and me on the beach. The sky is a calming purple-blue. Her hair is blowing across her face. We're both a little tipsy. Our feet are bare, toes digging in the warm sand, and the happiness in our expression is palpable. It's a great fucking photo. I stare down at it, spinning a little inside. I'm so used to seeing our faces together, so used to how she fits against my shoulder. I love her eyes and her skin and her smile. I love our wild moments and our quiet ones. love fighting and fucking and laughing with her. I love how easy we look side by side. I've spent the last few days agonizing over when to propose, but it occurs to me that this is when I do it, in this quiet space, when we're just us, having a perfect night. Amy and Lucas are down the beach a ways, walking in the lapping waves, and so it feels like we have this little stretch of sand entirely to ourselves. I turn to her. My heart is a thunder inside me. "Hey, you?" She grins at the phone, taking it from me. "This is cute." "It is." I take a deep breath, steadying myself. "Caption this photo," she says, oblivious to my internal mayhem, my mental preparation for one of the biggest moments of my life. I say, a little thrown, but thinking as I try to play along. And then she bursts out laughing. "Here's one." She said yes. She leans into me, cracking up. "Oh my God, this is a good picture of us, but this is exactly the kind of vacation photos people in Minnesota put on their mantle in shell-encrusted frames to remind themselves of the sunshine when we are in the deepest pit of winter." She hands the phone back to me. "How many Minnesotans do you think get engaged on the beach? 80%? 90%? Shaking her head, she grins at me. "What total?" And then she stops, her gaze moving over my face. It feels like a wad of cotton has lodged itself in my throat. Olive claps a hand over her mouth as realization draws her eyes comically wide. "Oh, shit. Oh, Ethan. Oh, shit." "No, it's okay." "You weren't, were you? Am I that big an asshole?" It isn't. "Don't worry." She gapes at me, eyes wide with panic as it becomes clear her sarcasm wasn't that far off the mark. "I am such a dick that I've broken your brain." I don't know whether to be amused by this destroyed attempt at proposing or bummed. It did seem like the perfect moment. I felt like we were on the same page, and then, nope, not even a little. "Ethan, I'm so..." "Ollie, it's okay. You don't know what I was going to say. You think you do, but you don't." Based off her unsure look, I add, "Trust me, it's all good." I lean in, kissing her, trying to get her to let go with a gentle bite to her lower lip, a growl that has her softening beside me, opening her mouth to let me feel her. It escalates until we're both a little out of breath, wanting to take it to the next place where clothes come off and bodies come together. But although it's getting dark, it isn't that dark or that empty out here on the beach. When I pull back and smile at her like everything is fine, I can sense the skepticism lingering in her posture, how she holds herself carefully like she doesn't want to make a wrong move. Even if Olive thinks I was going to propose, she still hasn't said anything like, "I would say yes, you know," or "I was waiting for you to ask." So maybe it's a good thing I didn't manage to get the words out. I know that her view of marriage has been marred by her parents and by Amy and Dane, but I also like to think that I've changed her views on long-term commitment. I love her wildly. I want this, want to marry her. But I have to accept the reality that it isn't what she wants, and we can live just as happily together forever without that ceremony binding us. God, my brain is a blender all of a sudden. She lays down in the sand, pulling me gently back so that she can curl on her side, her head to my chest. "I love you," she says simply. "I love you too." "Whatever you were going to say, sweetheart, let it go." She laughs, kissing my neck. "Okay, fine." We need a new subject, something to help us limp away from this crash. "You really like Lucas, don't you?" I ask. It had taken Amy almost a year to start dating again after the divorce. Dane held out hope that she'd take him back and that they could work things out, but I didn't blame her for not wanting to try. My brother didn't just lose Amy's trust in all this. He lost mine, too. Things between us have slowly gotten better, but we still have a long way to go. "I do," He's good for her. I'm glad you introduced them. I didn't think Olive would ever welcome another guy into her sister's life. She was protective at first, but at dinner one night, Lucas, doctor, adventure seeker, and widowed father of the most adorable 4-year-old I've ever seen, won her over. Ethan, she says quietly, pressing small kisses up my neck and along my jaw. She holds her breath, and then lets it out in a shaky exhale. I saw the ugliest dress the other day. I wait for her to continue, admittedly confused, but finally have to prompt her. Trust me, I'm riveted. Tell me more. She laughs, pinching my waist. Listen, it was this horrific orange, sort of fuzzy, like velvet, but not. Something between velvet and felt. Velvelt. This story keeps getting better. Laughing again, she bares her teeth against my jaw. I was thinking we could get it for Amy. As payback. I turn my face to hers. Up close, she's only individual features. Enormous brown eyes, full red mouth, high cheekbones, gently sloping nose. What? She rolls her eyes and growls. When she speaks, I see her bravery. It's the same Olive who blindly jumped from a platform to sail through the forest. I'm saying, maybe if we got married, she would have to wear the ugly dress this time. Struck dumb, all I can manage is, you want to get married? Suddenly unsure of herself, Olive pulls back. Don't you? Yes, totally, absolutely. I trip over my words, gathering her back close to me. I didn't think, if from earlier, I thought you weren't. She looks directly at me, chin up. I do. Olive slides over onto me, cupping my face. I think my joke earlier was totally Freudian. I thought maybe you would, but then we've been here a few days and you didn't, and then I was like, why shouldn't I do it? There's no rule book that says it has to be the man. I reach into my pocket and pull out the tiny box. It's true. It doesn't have to be me, and you can totally get down on one knee to propose, but just so you know, I don't think this ring would fit me. She squeals, rising to her knees to take the box. For me? I mean, only if you want it. I can go ask someone else if you... Olive shoves me, laughing. If I'm not mistaken, her eyes are a little misty. She opens the box and slides her hand over her mouth when she sees the delicate band lined with a halo of diamonds, the emerald-cut stone cradled in the center. I'll admit, I'm proud of myself. It is a pretty great ring. Are you crying? I ask, grinning. Drawing intensely positive emotion out of this woman makes me feel godlike. But of course, Olive would never admit to happy tears. No? I squint at her. You sure? Yes, she valiantly works to clear her eyes. I mean, I lean in for a closer look. It looks like you might be. Shut up. Gently, I kiss the corner of her mouth. Will you marry me, Oscar Olivia Torres? Her eyes close, and a tear breaks loose. Yes. Smiling, I kiss the other side of her mouth, and then slide the ring on her finger. We both look down at it. Do you like it? Her voice shakes. Yeah. Are you usually better at making conversation than you are with me? She laughs, tackling me. The sand is still warm at my back, and this little bundle of fire is hot all along my front, and I burst out laughing too. What a ridiculous, silly, mistake-ridden proposal that was. It was absolutely perfect. Thank you.
The Unhoneymooners was written by Christina Lauren and read by Cynthia Farrell and Deacon Lee. Editing and post-production by Matt Cartzonis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Unhoneymooners is available in print from Gallery Books. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, My Favorite Half-Night Stand by Christina Lauren. Read by Deacon Lee and Shayna Thibodeau.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.